Welcome to Waking Up Is Not Enough, Flourishing in the Human Space. Whether you awaken through meditation, spiritual practice, near-death experience, ingesting a mind-altering substance, or being born again, you still return to your messy life without any special instructions. In this podcast, Polly Young-Eisendrath and Michael Berger talk with scientists, spiritual teachers, and other experts about how awakening can connect to a new path for flourishing and development on which waking up is important, but not enough, and growing up is never finished. Polly and Mike bring different kinds of expertise to the conversation. Polly is a psychologist, Jungian analyst, mindfulness teacher, author, and longtime practitioner of Zen Buddhism, as well as the founder and director of the Center for Real Dialogue. Mike is an expert in psychedelics, an entrepreneur, a skeptic, a practitioner of Jewishness, a documentary filmmaker, and a Real Dialogue specialist. The Center for Real Dialogue produces and edits this podcast entirely through donations. We want to keep it available for free to our listeners. Our unique perspective needs to be supported by people like you. Please make a donation on our GoFundMe platform, introduce our podcast to family and friends, and support us on social media. We genuinely need the support of all of our entire community, and we're grateful for it.
Human consciousness is self-consciousness. A conversation with an authority on human consciousness, Dr. Michael Lewis. You may be confused about the word consciousness because it is used broadly to mean anything that has awareness of any kind, from a fungus to a dolphin to a human being. Unfortunately, this has been the way we speak with each other about consciousness since Darwin came onto the scene. Consequently, as humans, we do not know what our unique features of consciousness are, nor how they are related to our emotional development and our lives. You may know the word ego, but you probably do not know how it relates to your self-conscious emotions, like shame or guilt, or even that you have self-conscious emotions. In this podcast, you will find out precisely the meaning of how humans are conscious, because you will hear a conversation with Dr. Michael Lewis, an expert on human consciousness. The psychologist Dr. Michael Lewis from Rutgers University is famous for providing the exact test and the precise investigation of the birth of self-consciousness in humans. We are the only organism here on Earth that is aware of its awareness in such a way that we abstract and theorize our own identities. Then, of course, we fight about them also and get polarized. In this conversation, Dr. Lewis talks with Polly and Mike about the beginnings and the developments of human consciousness. Dr. Lewis is the foremost researcher on self-consciousness and self-conscious emotions in the United States, having spent 65 years investigating them in his laboratory at Rutgers University. Michael Lewis, PhD, is University Distinguished Professor of Pediatrics and Psychiatry and Director of the Institute for the Study of Child Development at the Rutgers University Robert Wood Johnson Medical College. He is also Professor of Psychology, Education, and Biomedical Engineering at Rutgers. Dr. Lewis is a fellow of the New York Academy of Sciences, the American Psychological Association, the American Association for the Advancement of Science, and the Japan Society for the Promotion of Science. He's one of the most prominent social scientists in the United States and is a recipient of the Yuri Bronfenbrenner Award for Lifetime Contribution to Developmental Psychology from the American Psychological Association, and the Distinguished Scientific Contribution Award in Child Development from the Society for Research in Child Development.
It's great to be here with the two Michaels, Michael Lewis and Michael Berger, both of whom I consider to be friends, and also with Michael Lewis, actually a great inspiration for my work as a developmental psychologist and also as an author over a long period of time. So I'm so happy to be with you again, Michael Lewis.
Unfortunately, you may know more about me than I you. So
most likely that is true.
Puts me at a disadvantage.
Well, you know, I don't know. On this podcast, we do interview a lot of people like Zen masters and Zen teachers. And the idea that you don't know who you are is considered a very sort of mark of high wisdom, you know, because in the end, who does know anyway? It's a very complicated project being a human. So, you know, the I don't know is actually considered a very wise answer in the Zen tradition. So, you know, I want to start first with Michael, just to ask you to give us a little bit of an overview of your own career now that you're retired and what you consider to be your greatest contributions, because you have many, many years, I think 65 years in your lab. You've made lots and lots of contributions to developmental psychology and research on human emotion. So how do you look at your career now and what you're sort of seeing as your greatest contributions?
Well, thank you for those remarks. It's kind of interesting that you ask, because it's thrown me back into me again, as it did in old age, as it did in adolescence, as it did when I became orphaned at an early age and had to make my way in the world. And so it's an interesting question, and interesting more for me perhaps than another, because how did I get to where I got and who that is should be a question that you ask as you approach less than a month. I'll be 88, which means that I'll be 90 before I blink. And so I have done many things, and I've had the opportunity to think about many things, in part because I moved three times in my career, which is not very much in academia, but they were very different. And each one was a different environment in which there were others in that environment. And so in the earliest part of my life, for the first 6 years, I moved to Yellow Springs, Ohio, a town of 2,000 people, lived on a pig farm with a new wife, started to work on physiological issues related to thinking and thought and learning. And so I studied heart rate and respiration. I got interested in the physiological, the ANS, how it related to behavior, and discovered from that experience that the relationship between what we say and how our bodies act, where we look, what our heart rate does, what our respiration does, what our GSR does, all of them autonomic nervous system responses, which are supposed to go with behavior. And there I discovered, while there is some relationship, it's extraordinarily loose. Now, it's a phenomenon which, in fact, now in computer and advertising, everyone who wants to sell something knows, which is what you say you like and what you actually will buy can be very different. If I buy a particular brand of X, they will show me more of X brand material, but the smart programmers will send me Y and Z and others. In other words, they will watch my behavior rather than what I'm saying. Behavior turns out to have more meaning to our, less meaning to our physiological state. And I will just add an addition to that, which my own interest in stress and looking at stress hormones, thinking, wow, I can get a good internal measure of stress. I don't have to ask an infant anything. I will look at its stress, its cortisol responses. And when I do so, I find a very weak association between the behavior of the baby. And by the way, it's true for adults as well, but there is very little. And I wrote a paper some time ago talking about the inside and the outside, and that there are very little relationship. So a crying baby can mean either that it wants something or that it's upset. We tend to think of crying as a passive response, but in an organism without a passive. So in fact, they need an active, and the only thing they have available is to cry. So in that environment, I got very much interested in studying behavior as it relates the outside to inside measures, which were acceptable. And it was early and people weren't doing that. And they didn't care much that they were not highly related. And it turns out to be important. And that was at Fells Research Institute. I got my PhD in 1962, and I was there till 1968. And so I learned a great deal from the folks who were there. I next went to Educational Testing Service, and there was an educational environment. And there I became interested in educational issues. What is the environment like, and how does the child involve itself in environment? So, for example, I taught the child to pull a string to turn on pictures, and I could determine whether they could learn to pull the string in order to get the pictures. And they do learn. It turns out that one-month-old babies will soon increase their pulling response. But I also was interested in what happens when it stops working. In other words, a kind of stress response, and suddenly discovered that I had a paradigm for studying emotional development, which then carried me into my third career, the longest, which was at a medical school, where in fact, dysfunctional development becomes the focus. So in a certain sense, each of these environments contributed to, as I tried to gather greater information about the organism I was interested in. Now, I have to put that forward, but to the side, I want to mention that I got two PhDs, one in clinical psychology, in which individual difference was very important to me, and the second was process. And so I could study both individual differences as well as process. And I learned a great deal from understanding that the mean response has no meaning. There is no mean, that there are groups of individuals, and you may group some of them together in certain ways at certain times, but not always. And so these kinds of distinctions at group level could be age, it could be gender, it could be cultural, but individual differences surrounded all of those. And so not only did I do psychotherapy in the first environment, but then I had children and I had enough to do with research and children. And so I gave up doing therapy for the most part, more consulting than one-on-one therapeutics. So what holds all that complexity together? I haven't missed your question. I'm just trying to say that it's complex. And I guess it would have to be the emotional development measured in multiple ways, and the idea that there is an organism between the world and oneself. And the old SS theorists always had talked about a stimulus, the subject, and the response. And having been in this field a long time, I knew that and remembered that. And I came to understand that I had to understand something about what the self is. So I would argue that if I went by what is still active in people reading and lecturing about referencing, it would be that combination of the self in its socio-emotional context. It's the self to the self, it's the self to the other, it's the other's response to the self, in which the self becomes the central object. The most interesting thing in that, one of the famous early scientists in perception, J.J. Gibson, talked about that psychology was not the psychology of the response, but the psychology of the stimulus. And that you can see in the TAT test or the Rorschach, in which the same events are presented to different people, and there what they see and how they interpret it is a measure of the self. In those cases, they were used for pathology, but one could broaden that and simply say, we want to talk about the self. So I would say, as I try to understand me and a lifetime now, it's me that I'm still trying to understand. It's me as a young boy that was family and orphan. It was me as a young scientist, and it's now me as an old man. And indeed, I become an old man. And that's a very interesting thing, because I certainly don't feel like an old man, but I am an old man.
So, Michael, I wanted to just say something about my acquaintance with your work. I'm glad you moved through it in such a cogent way. You did move through it in a cogent way, in case you wonder. And when I was at Bryn Mawr College. I was actually there. I left after I got tenure. I was there for about 12 years. And I intersected with your work through Harvey Horowitz at the Institute of Pennsylvania Hospital. I don't know if you remember Harvey. So Harvey first probably introduced me to your work, but I did my doctorate under Jane Lovinger at Washington University, and I had come across your work in her research, which is on ego development, so different paradigms for the self, essentially. A critical issue in the development of any human being is this formation of self-referential, you know, capacity, which you, more than anyone else, at least in my acquaintance, focused on in your research on the so-called self-conscious emotions, or, you know, they have otherwise been called sometimes social emotions. I feel that the self-conscious label is important and really necessary. You know, your work focuses on this formation. And now you're saying in your own reflections on yourself, you also focus on this kind of self-referential capacity that you could sort of know who you were when you were young. Of course, you're very different now, or when you were young in your career, and then as you age over time, and then to reflect on yourself now as you know, a so-called old man, even though you don't feel that way internally. So what I understand from what you're saying is that where you began was on that issue of sort of what is inside and what's outside, and then what is individual and what is group. And gradually you formulated something that was fairly precise. I'm going to say that anyway, which is this interest in how does a child, a human child, become something different, I'm going to say it this way, than a mammal. You know, there's a commonality between the human infant and other mammals in terms of the way we're organized emotionally. But something happens to the human in a way that Darwin forgot to specify, I think, which is that the human forms the self and this self-awareness. And wondering if you could talk to us, now that you've introduced your framework and also yourself, if you could talk to us about the way you define this human self, and also, I would say, the way you have responded to Darwin. You have great respect for Darwin. I know you do. I've seen that in all of your work. But you also want to respond to Darwin. You don't want to say that Darwin has the last word on emotions. So if you could speak to the issue of what is the human self, and how you, let's say, I'm not sure it's not a critical response to Darwin, but more like an addendum, or no, I would say a different conversation.
Darwin's problem was, in fact, that he wanted to connect emotional life in animals from an evolutionary point of view through to humans. And he got actually in trouble, which most people don't know, because he included what were called imbeciles and idiots, who we call intellectually challenged, emotionally challenged, to be somewhere between the ape and the human. He also included African-American bias and wrote about it, that these were somehow some connection. So Darwin's observations are acute, but they were really around a particular topic, and it was the topic of evolutionary change and how that came about.
Are you saying that he was a kind of a eugenicist, or he leaned into eugenics, or... I just want to be clear.
Unfortunately, a dear relative of his was the leader of eugenics. Darwin was certainly immersed in the idea that led to the fittest survive, and with the idea of improving the most fit by eliminating the most unfit. So there is some truth to that, but I wouldn't go as far. Darwin really didn't write exclusively on it. He did write, in fact, as he tried to create an evolutionary scale, wanted to go from the great ape into humans. That was the objective. It wasn't, and in fact, his reluctance was that humans were not uniquely made, but made in the same fashion as apes who descended from monkeys, who descended from other beasts, and so on.
Early American psychology was affected by eugenics very much. And I think many people don't realize that there were assumptions that would now be considered really problematic.
Darwin really didn't have it all. And you know, what we have to do, since we all believe in a great individual, a story of development, and that's silliness. I mean, it doesn't work that way, okay? Someone develops a telescope that can become also a microscope, and all of a sudden, big things far away and small things close suddenly can be studied. And so the importance is, often in the history of science, is the discovery of measurement technique, which is something we'll get to in a moment. So when I hit upon, there were several work that informed me that there might be techniques that I could employ with young children to watch not only emotion. I was more and first interested in what the self might be, and how might we measure it, okay? Now, the only way we can extrapolate, all of us sitting around and talking about it, is to say some really interesting things about the self. It was someone who said, there are things I know and I know I know. There are things I know and I don't know. And there are things I don't know which I know about. All of those are true.
That's a Rumsfeld. Rumsfeld.
Anyone who's thought about it knows that whatever this thing we call me is made up of parts which are available and parts which are not available. And if we don't think about it that way, we tend to think of the self only in one way. And consciousness and the self are very much related. And unfortunately, there's some confusion between it. Okay, the self has a part, has knowledge, which I don't have. For example, I go to the dentist and he's going to fill a tooth. And so he gives me Novocaine and he says, does it hurt? And I say, no, it doesn't hurt. So am I in pain or do I feel pain? Pain turns out to be the absolute essence of getting in to this issue, okay? It could be that the pain I feel, which I don't feel, but some part of me may feel that it's not available, is part of me. We know that the self is greater than that which we know about. And indeed, in my most people, that self-reflection or the awareness of the self is simply unknown. They behave as if they know it, but they don't know it. So how are we going to study something now like pain or like consciousness in the self? And now we're going to get all tied up now in brain science, which has got everyone's ear, so to speak. And so people are going to talk about self as a certain wavelength of a certain duration. Okay, those are all measures. And it's typical, and that's why I mentioned the measurement issue before. Because we have to be very careful what we're going to talk about. And I'm talking about knowledge that I have that it's me. Now, I may have behavior without necessarily having a verbal response to it. So, for example, at about the time of the measurements that I take and have talked about, there are in the literature 2-year-olds who have gained the notion of possession. Possession, drawing, they draw things, and then you show them things that they've drawn and other 2-year-olds have drawn, and you say, which one is yours? And surprisingly, they get pretty good at it. By the same time that they start to look in a mirror and touch their nose, which is the technique that I discovered and utilized in much of my work, which turns out to be a critical moment. Does the child know that's me, that it sees in the mirror with a little rouge on its nose and touches its nose? Yes, it is. But how does it know it's me? Well, there are 2 other measures that we take, which are highly related. And the first one is personal pronoun, me and mine. They enter the language of human children, English speakers, by 2 years of age, around 2 years of age. And they will say me or mine. And if they say mine, they'll take the object and bring it toward them. It's a possession. This is mine. And they use me or mine. So that's one measure beside the nose. Nose is simply, they have some perceptual knowledge of that image is located in space right here on my nose. Now, I'm using words they don't have, but they can do that. The third turns out to be something that Piaget discovered, which was that certain kinds of play behavior, which are called imitation play, are learned very early and eventually drops out to just be imitation. But there is play, literally, that is fantasy. And the amazing thing is that occurs at the same time. So I took a collection of measures and I said, wow, are they related? Do they occur at the same time? Is there a coherence in it so that I can say that the child has some notion of self? Okay. I have no proof outside that. I can't ask them. So what can I look for proof? I can look, for example, at embarrassment. Embarrassment is an emotion that takes place when you are the object of another's attention. And that has to do, as we subsequently learn, with we take care to look at the eyes of the other person. So when you go to a meeting and you put on your chest on your name, and a person comes over to you who you think should remember your name, you could tell if their eyes glance down. You can spot it, okay? If you really wanted to do it a secret, it should be on your forehead. On your chest, you can spot. So the fact is, it turns out that embarrassment does not emerge until you can do those 3 things. Look in the mirror and touch your nose. Have work for me or mine. And have play behavior. So it's a 3-point scale.
The issue of the identification of the nose, let's just say that's me, personal pronouns. But the third one the pretend, that one, you know, which you have very nicely associated with self-consciousness, is one that many, many people don't realize that there's an abstraction going on. There's the formation of an abstraction, and that ability to abstract ourselves is one of the uniquely human things that both is a gift and becomes a problem. You know, I mean, we can abstract ourselves in killing enemies that we've never seen. We can abstract ourselves by creating a life that we don't even know about. You know, we begin to believe that we could move to Montana and be a cattle rancher, but we've never done that. There isn't any other mammal that does any of these things that we do around being able to abstract our own subjectivity and then pretend in our imagination and then do something about that, you know? And that issue of the way that humans behave is something that I believe is still not clarified to many social psychologists, to many clinical psychologists. They don't recognize very specifically this capacity of the human self to abstract itself, to imagine itself some other place, and it's not there from birth. It begins as part of development, 18 months to 2 years old. And as you've pointed out, if it doesn't begin, there's a real problem there. So if you could kind of also just to take this theme of the way that our self forms and then what we do that's very human, that others, you know, the animals are not doing these things.
No, I think you've mentioned several very important factors. One of course, is the engagement in what is not real. That is to say, when the child picks up a teacup and with nothing in it and presents it to the doll, that child knows that it isn't tea in it, and the doll doesn't drink it. So pretend is indeed the beginning of fantasy and the beginning of poetry and the beginning of differentiating between the real and the imagined. And you're absolutely right in terms of it not receiving the thought. It was one of the things on my agenda to look at, because indeed, and this comes out of Piaget's work originally, although there have been others since, it was essentially Piaget arguing at later date for the emergence of the being able to discriminate between real and not real, which has to be part of the self. I know that this is not so. So it's a negation of your own behavior, which would lead you to believe that you think it is so. So now, here's where language could get you into trouble. On the discovery that there were techniques to measure something that I would call awareness of the self. Now, are they aware of it? How would we find that out? We can only find it out through behavior, and now we can start to expand the behavior. So we know from the embarrassment literature, and it's sometimes called shy, it's a mess. It really, the literature needs to be cleaned up. As an aside, I have to tell you, I've spoken many times to many psychiatrists and also clinicians, clinical psychologists, but mostly psychiatrists, and they can't define the difference between guilt and shame. It's just simply a mess. It's a mess. And what I decided to do that I could do was to try to clean it up, to write enough in enough places to make the differentiation between the two and to argue that some occur at the time when, in fact, you become the object of attention of others. If that occurs, when you can do the mirror and you have the language, and you have the play. And so we did a very simple study. We never published it because that's too much to do it and publish. And you know, you get tired. I don't know, 35 books and hundreds of articles. It was enough already. Very simple. You bring the child in the room. These are 15 to 18 month olds. And many of them have the nose. That is, they show us there's an operating self system. We point to the child. We have three people in the room. At a point signal, they all point to the child and say, Polly, 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 or Mike, 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 point, and say their name. And you get embarrassment. You get a perfect measure of embarrassment. Head sort of back and forth. It's sort of like coy looking. In fact, it's where men and women start to differ in their head turning. Look at any magazine. You find women turn their head slightly. Men look straight on. But it's this coyness, which is part of the embarrassment complex. And they touch themselves. Second measure of embarrassment, self-conscious embarrassment. And third, they often, and many of them, get upset. They bury their head. They, in real upset kids, they cry. And what I really wanted to do is to get a range of these kids, because the kids who cry, when you pay attention to them and they see you paying attention, get upset over it. Those are the kids who can't raise their hand in college to ask a question because it would be silly and people would make fun of them. They are self-conscious in the more typical meaning of it. They are watching out that they don't. So these, it turns out to be the timid kids, the kids in school age and early school who have trouble walking in a room. A child who walks in the room and everyone turns toward them because they've arrived as the last person, is the child. These children are the children who get upset. So here's another measure. But it's not every child, but it's a measure for enough to indicate that if you show embarrassment in appropriate situations, so the kids who don't touch their nose, the kids who don't play in a symbolic way, and the kids who don't have me in mind, they don't get upset when you point to them and say their name, okay? Because there's no, they're not point, you're not pointing to anything. They don't know what this is. When you know this, you know there's a me in some way, if you had a language, the language of me. So what turns out is that emotions get heavily tied to the self. And one of the ways in is through studying emotion, and in particular, the self-conscious emotions, which, by the way, have been called the moral emotion, the social emotions, and I've called them the self-conscious, okay? And they include shame, guilt, pride, hubris as the major configuration.
Do you include jealousy and envy typically in your group? Because, of course, from psychoanalysis, jealousy and envy are very big themes, you know, the envy being the destructive of the other person's thing and jealousy being the competition.
That's a very interesting topic. You're right in what you're saying. You could put them in. I don't know if they certainly will not occur until there's a self, in either jealousy or in envy, or in guilt, or in shame, or in pride, or in hubris, which is a false pride. And it turns out where you direct the object of attention in the other versus yourself is how you distinguish between someone who is shame-filled, they're causing the problem, they're the bad person, or guilt, which is guilt and regret, which they've done something to someone and they need to correct it. And so the correction, that is the more social form, is guilt and not shame. The problem, of course, is that Freud didn't have shame,
right?
Kinds of guilt, which really screwed up the whole movement. And it's mostly because Freud was just filled with shame. Just filled with shame. Jung knew it.
Right, right. And so I think the distinction between shame and guilt is such a key distinction for anyone who does clinical work, but there are many people that do not even know the distinction. And so therefore, and I don't want to leap into this too much, but Shame-based disorders often get diagnosed as depression, which they are not. And then many times there are occurrences of something like impulsive suicidal attempts because of shame-based disorder that's been now diagnosed as depression and treated often with a medication that will not help the shame and might even increase the impulse to suicide. So it's a serious distinction between shame and guilt. You know, your work does make that distinction very clear, especially your work on shame, which is, again, one of the reasons why I focused on your work a lot when I was kind of in the earlier parts of my career, where I was trying to figure out how to teach various things to graduate students. One really useful thing is the difference between shame and guilt, which, again, many people are not aware of, many clinicians are not aware of. And as you're saying it, because Freud suffered a great deal of shame, he did not theorize it in relation to guilt. He called it all guilt. So they can seem sort of technical, but they end up being really important, you know, from a practical point of view. So, but, you know, the one thing I wanted to bring Mike in a little bit, because Mike and I have had a conversation about, I don't want to, again, go too far afield here, but artificial intelligence not having any emotion, you know. And so I have said early on in our conversations, artificial intelligence cannot become conscious like humans are, because it cannot become conscious of itself. It might be able to imitate self-consciousness, but it doesn't have emotion. And so, to me,
that in itself is, of course, enormous. There is some way of going about it. I can only suggest, because I really didn't devote enough time in a therapeutic sense. But with students, I can tell you right off the bat, if I look at a paper they've done, and I say, you can get A, all of you, but I am going to be the criteria, because I'm the teacher, and I'm going to comment on your paper. And if you respond to the comments and so on and change it in the way, I mean, it sounds like social pressure, but it's really not. It's an idea of giving them an opportunity to reenact, which would be a therapeutic sense. And what you get is the following. You get only a certain percentage of the kids who will, in fact, repeat it, will try to make it better. And those turn out to be not shame-ridden. The shame-ridden are ones who take it, put it in the drawer, and walk away, because they have no mechanism except to forget it and get rid of it, which they can't do. So you can, in fact, tell. And I know any number of students who didn't go on, who could have gone on from an intellectual manner, but in fact could not bear not getting it right. And not bear getting it right, instead of, what are the ways I can improve it? So the focus is on me, and focus on improvement is the focus instead is I'm no good. Okay, I'm a failure. Nothing is good about me. And they have to walk away. There's no way. There is other ways, by the way. The Catholic Church has a wonderful means of confession, because the person is given an opportunity to confess. Or in Judaism, when the day of confession, one day a year, where they can go right back to doing the same thing, but they're given forgiveness for confessing for doing. So, but it doesn't free them of it, because they always need the priest. They always need the rabbi to help them get along in a certain sense, or the therapist in a sense. But the whole idea is to change the focus away from me toward the object that I'm doing, the act that I'm doing, rather than myself. That turns out not to be so easy. But there are circumstances where one could do that, where one could teach to overcome, to do better, rather than to dismiss it, to try to forget it, and which is mostly what we do with shame. And that's why, of course, shame is prominent in getting you into therapy, but you can't talk about it. And so for the most part, you can never get to it to undo. So the attempt should be to clarify what we mean. And if I have any use here, is that I force people to try to behaviorally define what guilt or regret versus shame look like. And I have accurate descriptions of it, and it can be utilized. There are a lot of self-psychologists in Australia, and when my shame book came out, people who were self-psychologists invited me to come, and I went, and I would spend a month teaching the therapist, the analyst, and I could show in videotape of therapeutic situations where shame takes place in the part of the patient. I wouldn't do it in part of the therapist, but you can actually see it. But what you have to see is flashes. It requires a kind of therapeutic sensitivity, or else photographing it. And you get a head drop, you get a collapsing of the body in shame in an exaggerated form, and you get difficulty speaking. And if you speak, the use of I is often repeated in excess of what a normal speech. So you can catch it, but it's going to be a quick head down and up, maybe missed. All one can ask is that in fact we come aware of the things that do it. Okay? And I am very clear with the people I know and love to simply say, you can't tell me you can't. You can't say you're a failure. You have to just keep trying and see what it leads to. It's not going to hurt you, and so on. And with care for another and with some connection, you can succeed. But it's very hard to get people not to be ashamed.
Enjoyed this episode of Waking Up Is Not Enough, Flourishing in the Human Space? Please consider supporting Waking Up Is Not Enough by contributing to our GoFundMe campaign. You can find the campaign linked in the description. Don't forget to hit like, subscribe, and tap the notification bell so you never miss an episode of insightful discussions and explorations into the human psyche. Waking Up Is Not Enough was edited and produced by Chris Coltrane.